Our message today is our daily bread. If you were on the Jeopardy show, Alex would make you put that in the form of a question. And our question is, what's for dinner? We will explore today the changing connection between food, faith, and family. How do families make tasty, nutritional food choices that fit with their ethical and their spiritual values? And a good place to start is dinner time. Dinner is ready, so where is everybody? When did it get so difficult to gather the family around at the dinner table? It has become a burden. In many households, members are overwhelmed by school, overwhelmed by work and paying bills, and those many household chores. We have busy, busy schedules out there. Drained by the demands of the day, we sometimes skip breakfast and often skip dinner at our regret. Now, I may be guilty a little bit here of remembering the good old days that never were. Sometimes I confuse what it was like with the Norman Rockwell painting, particularly of the family sitting around dinner time. The image that comes to mind, though, includes this. And the family I grew up, I think there was assigned seating. The TV was off. I think even if Walter Cronkite was doing his thing, if we had a phone, I'm sure that phone would not have been answered. And it would be understood that you would be there on time. In my family, 5:30 was dinner time. And Tuesday night, that was special. Meatloaf, mashed potatoes. It was an important ritual. Not only the meatloaf and mashed potatoes, but you got that sense of being connected, a sense of belonging. People cared what you said. Somehow, even with bigger families, four or five or six kids, the homemaker, that's code for mom, it was really mom, who was able to put dinner on the table every night. The family has been changing, and corporate food industry, they have been watching. They have found out today 60% of our meals are consumed outside of the home. Snacking accounts for 50% of our eating occasions. Industry now calls our dinner time flex time or flex eating. A family of four may be eating at separate times and often different meals. It's not uncommon if somebody prefers meal that 12-year-old son will not want what's on the dinner and will go to the freezer and get an entree out, pop it in the microwave, and maybe to the room he goes to eat that. Companies are making food that tailors to this changing family experience. By the way, tomorrow, April 12th, KFC is opening up their new, it's called a double down sandwich. It's without a bun, it's chicken, bacon, with cheese, a lot of calories there, I think. But it's designed to be consumed with one hand. So theoretically, I guess you can keep your iPod or cell phone or steering wheel in the other hand. As you can see, food is becoming an accessory. In that age-old question, what was for dinner? That was shaped by deeply held cultural traditions, who we were, and by family life, by mom, and by recipes, and of course, that back garden that many of us had in our backyard. By default, today's menu is dominated by food experts, government policy, and a $40 billion food industry. Just between you and I think they're motivated probably more by profits and efficiency rather than the health and well-being of the people they make. Can we reclaim the harmony between food, family, and our faith? Where do we start? I'd like to start in the beginning. The second creation in Genesis describes a garden planted by God and tendered by the first human couple who live in harmony with the plants and animals. I can almost imagine Adam and Eve sitting around the dinner table. The harmony was broken, however. Adam and Eve were evicted from the garden, and now they must struggle on their own. It's a tough world out there. God says, "Be fertile, multiply, fill the earth, and master it. Rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and all the living things that creep on the earth." And I think that was God's equivalent to the federal government's food pyramid, telling us how to eat. You put down the Bible and pick up an anthropology book, you'll get a different take on the history of food and people. According to biology, we humans are vertebrates, we're primates, and we're mammals. With an engaging GI tract and a variety of teeth, we have molars, canines, incisors, and premolars. That means we can grind, shred, chew, do just about anything can possibly be food. We are, after all, omnivores. Roots, shoots, nuts, berries, plants, and animals, that's all fair game for our diet. In addition, we get in touch with our inner animal. We're also a cultural being. We have big brains. We make lots of tools. We have language. And as a result, it has put us rather high in the food pyramid. Being high on the food pyramid has some advantages. You're more likely to be a hunter than the hunted. If you bump into something, you're more likely to eat it. It's not going to eat you. Here's an example of the food chain. It takes 12 tons of grass to feed 27 million grasshoppers. It takes 27 million grasshoppers to feed 90,000 frogs. It takes 90,000 frogs to feed 350 fish, and it takes 350 fish to feed one person a year. We are hunters and gatherers. Like our ancestors. They've been hunting and gathering for 99% of our time on Earth. That's several million years out there. Even 2,000 years ago, if you would go along Piesaw Creek or the Illinois River Valley, you would find people there who were hunting and gathering. Guys would get up in the morning, make their own tools, and out they would go for animals. And they had a rather strong division of labor. Women would go out, not hunt, but gather. By the way, we now know women gathered most of the calories. They usually brought in about 80% of the food intake. And I think when I read the archaeology, it looks like these valleys were a local Garden of Eden. Some of the evidence would suggest they were eating fish, waterfowl of many variety, eastern elk, now extinct here, turtles, mussels, small mammals, sunflowers, seeds, roots, berries, nuts, pecans, acorns, all kinds of wild plants and animals. If the elk got scarce, or the animals got scarce, they merely pack up and go 10, 15 miles out of the way. But shifts happen. I better repeat that. Shifts happen. Hunters become farmers. About 100 years ago in the River Valley, major changes took place. Hunters became farmers. These nomadic people began settling down, and they planted the Three Sisters. Corn, beans, and squash. And there's some ancient wisdom there. You poke one hole, put three seeds in, they all come up about the same time. Beans off give off nitrogen, and the corn goes crazy on that. And when you eat those three, you get complete proteins. It didn't take long. On those three crops, Cahokia Mounds became a city. That was their dominant food crop. We call that progress, but not so fast. Once we looked back, actually archaeologists studying the bones, they found out bones can talk. They compared the bones of the hunters and gatherers with the bones of those people who ate the Three Sisters. Guess who was more healthy? It was the hunters and gatherers. They lived longer. They had no cavities, which is amazing. They had fewer arrested bone growth rates. They had no iron deficiencies. Now, the advantages of being a farmer is that your quality doesn't improve, but you get more quantity. So in many ways, they traded quality for quantity, more food to support more people. Today, evolution works very slow. You and I still have the bodies of hunters and gatherers. We still have the brains of hunters and gatherers, and we still have the appetite of hunters and gatherers. But we don't live along the Piesaw Creek. Some of us do, but not in nature any longer. Now we do our hunting and gathering in the aisles of Snooks, Walmart, and Shop and Save. Our base camps around the fire heart now are McDonald's, Applebee's, Steak and Shake. Today we use dollars, time, and taste, not nature, to shape our food choices. Now when I walk into Snooks or Shop and Save, Jen allows me to do all the shopping in there. I am amazed at the varieties. You have 40 to 50,000 different items you can choose from. You can get strawberries. I tasted some tasty strawberries out there. 52 weeks out of the year. In the dead of winter, you can get grapes from Chile. Last week, I bought a pineapple from Costa Rica. Our diet now has a global reach out there. And choices, I now can go to the orange juice area, and I'm overwhelmed. I think there's 60 different types of orange juice. I could spend 10 minutes there trying to make my choice. And it's a great problem to have. Too much. We are the land of plenty. But behind these full shelves and all this availability, there is a dark side to our food production. I'd like to talk just about two or three of the behind the scenes or invisible issues we probably as Unitarians should become aware of. First one is hunger. By the way, we no longer call hunger hunger anymore. It's now called food insecurity. Between you and I, it's hunger. Since I was born, 4 million people have been added to the global population. Today, around 7 billion people inhabit planet Earth. One out of six, that's over 1 billion people, suffer from chronic hunger. That means they're consuming 1,600 calories or fewer a day. And there are 16,000 people who starve to death daily, invisible to us. It's a problem of production. Some people argue, like our corporations, we're not producing enough food. Other people, Ron, as we were having our conversation, argue it's too many people. As we argue whether we need to grow more food or we have too many people, starvation continues. But we don't have to travel to third world countries to find starvation, or at least hunger. We all know hunger is a persistent local problem in our own countries and our own communities. Your monthly donations of food to the Alton Crisis Food Center, I think you've been doing that for at least a decade. I talked to the coordinator there, and she said last year, 2009, they provided 1 week per month of food for over 22,000 people. In the city of Alton, over 22,000 people don't have enough food. Hunger in America is really, I think, a symptom of poverty. We have 38 million people who fall in that category. 7 or 8 million of them are kids. Now, I think starvation is very rare, but meals are skipped. And quite often, if you're in poverty, you select filling foods, foods that make you feel full. They're high in calorie and low in nutritional quality. We seem to be the first generation, particularly the children now, who are overfed, but undernourished at the same time. A second dark side related to this is health issues. Hunger and obesity are often the flip side of the same malnutrition coin. Childhood obesity doesn't discriminate, however, whether you're middle class or low income. The typical 12-year-old child, now 25% of them are medically diagnosed as obese. If you're 12 years old, 25% of them now are labeled diagnosed. Overweight children are more likely to experience diabetes, other health-related issues, as well as psychological stress, sometimes reporting low self-esteem. I don't think the problem occurred overnight. I don't think it's going to disappear overnight. And I think the underlying causes are very complex. But stated simply here anyway, it's kids consume more calories than they're burning up in their daily activities. A second health concern, and I've not seen the headlines lately, but every once in a while there are media grabbing headlines that talk about food contamination, massive salmonella outbreaks from peanut butter. If you recall those, it just fades in our memory. I'm a peanut butter eater, and I gave up peanut butter for a while. E. coli in our hamburger. Maybe it was in our spinach, maybe it was in our onions, or it could have been in our tomatoes, or maybe the lettuce. The FDA wasn't really sure. They said we really couldn't find a smoking gun on that. Our food supply annually sickens about 70 million of us. Sometimes, you know, when you think we have the flu, It may be from food contamination. And unfortunately, 5,000 people die every year in America from contaminated food. The third dark side, if you will, the invisible concern about food, is what it does to nature, what it does to the earth. It is the food we eat, not our transportation, not our housing, that has the largest impact on the natural system. Our ecological food footprint accounts for 40% of all greenhouse gases that are known to cause climate change. Our food supply is fuel intensive. If you consume the average American diet, I'm not always sure what the average American diet is, you also consume about 400 gallons of oil. Standing in the way between that tomato in the field and the pasta sauce on your plate are pesticides, packaging, and 2,000 miles. Another concern on the environment, our Illinois and Iowa farmers, good for them, congratulations to them, they help feed the world. They use industrial strength farm inputs, high yielding seeds, pesticides, inorganic fertilizers, huge John Deere tractors and equipment, and they can ramp up production. Now, I'm amazed, production used to be about 25 bushel of corn per acre. Today, it's up to 200 bushel per acre. But that's not without cost. Whenever you produce a bushel of corn, about 2 bushel of topsoil goes into Piesaw Creek, which goes into the Mississippi River, which goes into the Gulf of Mexico. That nitrogen fertilizer, which is really puts corn on steroids, really makes it grow well. When you have summer rain events, it washes into the Mississippi River, goes down to the Gulf of Mexico. The algae just blooms on that and then dies. And when it dies, it sucks all the oxygen out of the water. Anything that's in that zone dies. Last year, we had an 8,000 square mile dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. If you like shrimp coming up from the Gulf, that should be a concern. And dead zones, apparently we have over 400 dead zones on planet Earth. So given the dark side, if you and I were to eat a healthful diet for our mind, for our body, for our spirit, and also planet Earth, what would it look like? Would we have to go back to the ancient wisdom of the hunters and gatherers? Just between you and I hope not. Harvesting wild plants and animals? Or should we look to the future? Should we invest in genetically modified miracle seeds coming out of the high-tech labs of Monsanto? I don't think we have to do either one. I think we already know what we need to do. It's not that complicated out there. And I'm going to come up with 4 or 5, I think, principles we can use, and I think they fit well with UU principles. Those 7 principles we have at the back of our service program, if we would follow those, I think we would eat well. Principle number 1, reach for real food. They are the foods that are as close to nature's state as they can possibly be. They've not been processed too much. They've not been saturated with salt, sugar, fat, chemicals that we're not really sure what impact they might have on us. Sometimes I do feel like a guinea pig. So I think for a real food is anything that has over 7 ingredients, probably put it down, walk away from it. I blew it up a little bit so I could see it. I came up with some ingredients, and you can tell me whether this is a real food or a manufactured food. Here's the ingredients: enriched wheat flour, corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup, dextrose, vegetable oil that may be made from canola, cottonseed, palm oil, kernel oil, they're not sure what oil, TBHQ, not sure what that is. It also contains more sugar, 2% or less of cracker meal, wheat starch, salt, dried strawberries, dried apples, dried pears, corn starch, leavening, can't pronounce that word, citric acid, modified wheat starch, caramel coloring, color added, reduced iron, red number 40. I like red number 40 personally. More words I can't pronounce, turmeric, and blue dye number one. That food is, I don't want to disappoint anybody, strawberry flavored Pop-Tarts. Lots of ingredients there. Michael Pollan has a great recommendation. Here's one of his books here. He said, when you go into the supermarket, take your grandmother with you, if she's available, or at least hear her voice. If your grandmother or great-grandmother comes over and picks up a food and says, what the heck is this? If she doesn't recognize it, set it down, walk away, and go somewhere else. So rule number one, reach for real food. Rule number two, put more plants on your plate. According to Michael Pollan in Defense of Food, his first line says, eat food, not too much, and mostly plants. Be careful on those foods, though. I was reading, our number one consumed vegetable is actually the potato. We live in the buckle of the potato belt. 60% of the vegetables we consume are potatoes, and they're usually served as French fries. You got that, yeah. Okay, and between you and I, French fries, heavenly, they're tasty. I like a little salt and ketchup on there, but you get quite a few calories. Pollan says, go for the bright colored leafy vegetables. That should end up on your plate. He also says, our diet is protein centered. We seem to be obsessed with meat. And he says, go easy on the meat. In India, the Hindu, they love cows. In the United States, we love beef. The typical middle-class American consumes about 55 pounds of beef yearly. If you count all meats, eggs, and cheese, that's about 200 pounds we get of protein. So principle two, put more plants on your plate. Principle number three, lean towards local and at least sometimes organically grown foods. Be careful with that word organic. It trips me up every time, or if I see the word natural, it just sets on a wrapper. It just sets things off in my mind. When I see organic, I imagine a guy, man, about my age, Biv Overhauls out there in a small field, little collie dog running around, has a Chevy pickup truck somewhere, rusting a little bit, growing those carrots. But it's more likely to be a 5,000 acre field, maybe in California, with oppressed workers who are actually processing that organic food. So when you can, go organic, but give it some thought. When possible, also bypass the supermarket, at least now and then, when the season permits, and eat local foods. That's good for the grower, good for the local economy, good for the consumer. And I think Alton and Edwardsville are really coming up with some dynamite farm markets on Saturday. So get there and you can engage in some great conversations and get some nutritiously locally grown produce. Sometimes when the apples and peaches are coming in Calhoun, stop along the roadside. You can talk to the grower, get a nice conversation, and really get some fresh local food. If families would eat locally consumed organic foods, it would reduce oil consumption by 50 million barrels a year. It seems like it would save a lot of oil. Watch out, but a lot of our food also has a global reach. And by global reach, that means some of our simple daily rituals, like eating a banana, having a cup of coffee, or that chunk of chocolate, we probably can't grow that locally. It probably comes from a third world country. And I'm amazed. I'm a coffee drinker. Officially, I have about 3 cups of coffee a day. Unofficially, we won't go there. And I like the daily ritual of a coffee. It's a good way to jump the start in the morning. Have a great conversation at the coffee shop with a friend, or just looking out the window on a rainy day. That coffee really kind of fits that bill. But that's not just a personal experience. There are 2 billion of us who are coffee drinkers out here. If I drink 3 cups of coffee a day, that means it takes about 12 trees or bushes about like this to take care of my yearly habit. When you multiply that times 2 billion coffee drinkers, we're talking a powerful impact on the tropical rainforest. So our food has a global reach. So we should be aware of that. Don't give up bananas. Don't give up coffee. Don't give up that chocolate. Become aware of who grows it, what impact it has on the environment. I was amazed. The number one traded commodity on the international market is oil. Number two is coffee. So we're talking big business here in the process. So principle number three, eat locally when you can. And if you eat globally, pay attention if you can to the impact. Principle number four, and I like that, I've talked to a number of you, you do grow gardens in here, is grow a garden. Don't have to dig up your whole backyard. Maybe a few plants on the patio is a good start, or a south-facing window. I like to grow a garden because it's as close as I get to a miracle. I know Unitarians aren't real big fans of miracles out there. It makes us a little nervous sometimes. But when you take the sun and soil and a seed and a little sweat, you put those four together, something green pops out of the ground. And if you're patient and wait, it could be a tomato there. And that tomato really is stored sunlight. That's pretty close to a miracle. So get busy out there. You grow a garden, you're going to burn some calories, and that's good for us. And it's going to unplug our mind just a little bit from the electronic entertainment. And you can also connect with a few neighbors. Maybe you can grow more tomatoes or zucchinis than what you think you can eat. You can also borrow some tools, maybe from a friend, or loan them some tools so you get to know your neighbors. First Lady Michelle Obama, I think it has exactly right. Get a garden going, get those kids out of the garden, and good things are going to happen. I'm a Garrison Keillor fan. I think some of you are in Prairie Home Companion, and I enjoy him working the narrative of the garden in Lake Wobegon. He says the second greatest pleasure in life is going out there when that sweet corn is just right, have the water boiling, get it in home, pop it in there. It's terrific. I wish he would tell me what the first greatest pleasure in life is. It would help in the process. I'll use my imagination. While we're reclaiming that garden, why not reclaim that kitchen anyway, now and then? It's a good place to prepare some of that produce in our backyards. Get out some of those family recipes now and then, and you can connect with your ancestors by following a few of those. Now, you don't have to follow those recipes exactly. The one that calls for four sticks of butter, use your own judgment call on that. That cup of coffee up on the stove with bacon grease, you don't necessarily have to go there. Two cups of lard, you use your own discretion. But family recipes, it really connects in terms of who we are. So principle number four, grow a little garden, start out slow, and it's a good time to connect. Principle number five, the ice caps and glaciers, they are melting. Remember, our biggest impact we have on the earth is the food we eat, so we need to clean our plates. That's another way of saying, let's not waste too much food. Apparently, we throw away about 30% of the food in America. Some people now who specialize in dumpster diving, not because they have to, but they go out where restaurants and some of the grocery stores throw their food, and they say, you can eat well there. I'm not going to try that. Reduce the plastic, the paper, the cardboard, the buttons, the cans, the styrofoams, and things that contain our food and drink. That has a big impact. And put our food waste, sometimes you do have some left over, throw it on a compost pile. Take that compost pile and throw it on the garden. So the earth is warming up, so let's get busy on that. And finally, eating food is more than just putting food in our mouth. We have to become mindful of our food choices, and that's going to take some time and some patience. And the good news, if you choose food that's good for you, it's going to be good for other people. It's going to be good for justice, and it's going to be good for the earth. So get out there and make some good choices. I'd like to leave you, sorry, running a little late, I just noticed there, is to take on a challenge. Maybe in September, we could have our great potlucks. We could try to make it with locally grown food, maybe some organic food, stuff we grow in our own garden, maybe home prepared, and maybe, I know this is reckless, but maybe we could make it a meatless menu just for that time. some food for thought.